So what could possibly be anyone's objection to providing the adequate funding for exascale?
Well, I don't know if there's ever any objection. I think that what happens in Washington is they have to make very difficult policy choices of where to do the investment. You know, do they invest in NIH research here? Do they invest in, you know, a new NASA probe there? I mean, there is a fixed number of dollars they have to invest in science R&D, and in some sense, you know, the ones that will have the largest impact for the nation should be at the top of the list. There's also, of course, science that gets funded that what I would say is curiosity-driven, right? It's not just about delivering results that will transform our understanding of something that matters to the country, like energy or biology or medicine, but also just we don't know how, you know, something works out in space or you know, down at the subatomic level, and we just want to know.
Yeah, I think that some of the discussions that I've heard, which were very interesting, I guess, is the only way I can describe it, was that, you know, well, we get to the level of having an exascale system or maybe two exascale systems, and for some period of time, perhaps several years, they will be applied to a very limited number of applications. So the argument of we need exascale because of all the possibilities of how it can change everything, you know, from the way we live on this planet to healthcare and so forth, is such a long-term argument that people lose sight of it because it's just not something that's going to return a short-term benefit. How do you feel about that?
Well, so you know, I'm a very firm believer in that these are long-term wins for the nation and for our country. These investments in science and technology. I mean, you've probably seen the numbers of, you know, high school students and college students who are in science and technology and where we are in this country with declining, you know, leadership in just in education in science and technology. And, you know, to fix that, of course, you can apply funds for education, but, you know, those students need to leave and, you know, and graduate and then have promising, exciting research projects and new technology that they are diving into, right? And you know, we have had tremendous leadership and growth in the internet services such as Google and Yahoo and Amazon and cloud, and we're you know, amazingly dominant position there. But when it comes to the underlying technologies of chip and software and science-based new materials, new ways to get, you know, whether it's solar power or new engines that are more efficient, you know, that space there can have a tremendous impact on our economy and on our life. You know, you can just imagine, just for a minute, if we can design through with high-performance computing and improve the efficiency of an engine, a combustion engine or a jet engine, the amount of fuel, which is, you know, we all pay for, the amount of fuel that's consumed can be dramatically lowered across as a, you know, entirety across the nation. You know, Pratt and Whitney, you know, ran code here at Argonne, and other folks have run code at Oak Ridge, and we've had GE running code here, doing explorations and having improved the efficiency of engines, and the impact that we can have is tremendous. But it depends really on a full system, full court press. You know, everything from education up to the deployment of these large systems. And it is not a short-term win. It's not a, okay, we're going to have a big system for 2 years or 3 years. The grad students who start working on this now will, you know, turn into PhD students, and that will turn into postdocs who then discover a new material, right? And, you know, that's a 10-year win for us. And so that's where we have to be sort of imagining our competitiveness in the world.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think a lot of folks get hung up on, you know, an exascale computer per se and picturing this mammoth beast, as opposed to thinking in terms of, you know, it's exascale levels of research, exascale levels of computation that we haven't had, you know, before. Yeah, it requires that mammoth, you know, computer system to do it, but I think if we start to focus at, you know, picturing this large platform, that's where the questioning starts to come in.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. You know, that is how we look at it here. You know, we you know, the popular press likes to look at the top 500, declare a winner, and then move to the next story.
Right.
And you know, you and I, you know, in this community know that that is not how it works, that we have, you know, dozens of PhD students and postdocs, or, you know, more than dozens, you know, hundreds across the nation working in a field that we have to, as a nation, we have to be number one. The design wars at the commercial level, the science-based understanding of our climate and what we need to do will affect policy, as well as you know, discovery of new drugs and new therapies, and how genetics, the impact of our society, you know, of the climate change. You know, these are all things that we want to be the authoritative source for, and have the experts in this country and attract them, continue to attract them here. And with that, we need a big, exciting, you know, moonshot. It's got to be something that really people really get excited about. And they have been getting excited about exascale computing, and because there's a lot of new technology. It's not just turning the crank on old stuff. The power constraint is very challenging. The parallelism, managing, you know, a billion threads of control, these require new concepts and new ideas, and these are the fantastic challenges for the PhD students working on this.
We featured you, as you recall, about 18 months ago it was, in the very first issue of the Exascale Report, and at that time, you had described, I think, you know, the journey toward exascale as being more revolutionary than, or you took the side of evolutionary versus revolutionary. Do you still feel the same way, Pete?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, I would say yes. It depends on your perspective, though. So we will have to have, you know, revolutionary components, because we haven't seen these things, some of these pieces before. But the overall architecture of how people compute, and using parallel decomposition of problems, and you know, all of those things, that stuff is not likely to change. So, you know, imagine for a minute, you know, just as an example, if we look at the revolution that's happening in the car industry. Right now, we're moving to electric vehicles. We have the Nissan Leaf, we have the Chevy Volt. These are revolutionary, but if you look at them, there are many parts that are evolutionary. They still have four wheels. They still require a powertrain. They still require anti-lock brakes, right? And all of these things need to be updated and redesigned in light of the new realities of the machine and the control systems. But there are new parts, right? The lithium-ion battery is a new part. The electric motors are new parts. So for us, it will be evolutionary. It'll still be a massively parallel system, but the new parts will be directly managing power, you know, management, directly managing resilience, and modifying our programming model to, you know, adapt to these new challenges. But it will still, you know, in large part, be the kind of thing that scientists have invested 20 years in. And so, just like the, you know, the 100 years of car driving that people have been doing here in the States or thereabouts, you know, that won't go away as we move to electric vehicles.
That's a great example. So Pete, do the overall, if you think back about 18 months ago, did the challenges seem different to you than they did 18 months ago?
Yeah, so know, we have had a set of meetings with the vendors, and they have provided some responses, and that has provided a very interesting sort of level set with respect to what the technology companies believe are their big challenges. And then, if you look at what's happening in the software space, we also realize that currently there is not a global overarching plan in the United States. We hope that one would emerge, but it looks like it's left on our to-do list to build a software plan for how to get the software done for exascale. So it's not just hardware. It's in fact, as you know, the hardware guys say that their job is the hardest, and the software guys say their job is the hardest. But what always ends up happening is the machine comes out, and then several years later, the software is done. So, you know, we might assume that the software is a very critical, if not the most critical part. So getting a jump on that now and getting some of these concepts of parallelism and power management resolved now would go a long way. But things have changed. The face of exascale has changed. Of course, internationally, people, other countries, based on our work with the IESP and other things, have become very involved. But there's also a realization, I think, globally, that leadership in this space will demonstrate or be necessary to lead other spaces, right? To lead design and engineering and health and climate.
So if you think about, we've had a lot of attention, I believe, particularly through the public media, toward exascale research labs being announced and developed mostly in Europe, I believe, the co-design centers and initiatives and so forth, the working groups like IESP. Do you think we've made really that much progress in 2011 in moving forward toward exascale?
Well, here in the States, we've been doing we've done some of the research, but a lot of the legwork to build the program. I think that while we started working on the exascale planning 3 years ago, that other countries have very quickly caught up. And if you look at, just as an example, at Europe, they presented in October, and I was at that meeting. They invited me to present as well. But the Europeans presented their unified plan the first draft of what an exascale program might look like. They presented that to the European Commission, and the European Commission was very favorably disposed and very interested. The Europeans had commissioned an IDC report so that they could understand their position in the marketplace. The Europeans had put together the economic impact and sort of the science impact, as well as what needed to be done. And they were asking the European Commission for several billion euros over the next 10 years. And the next stage for them is they've put together internally, it's not public yet, but they're putting together a more refined plan, which would then be part of the European Commission structure, their plan, and then they would, of course, issue calls. And in addition to that, the Europeans have bootstrapped three small projects. They're relatively modest, but they show the direction and eagerness and plans for the Europeans. Sort of their target. One of those, their hardware projects and hardware and software projects to sort of prototype possible exascale architectures. And the interesting thing is that one of those winners that's been funded, there are three. One of those is an all European design. So it's the ARM processor, put together by STMicro. And integrated by Bull. And so ARM plus STMicro plus Bull, if they can develop this, would give the Europeans a sort of a homegrown prototype for exploring exascale. And I think that they are very serious about this and have fantastic technology in this area. You know, the iPhone that I have in my pocket uses an ARM processor.
That's right.
And, you know, the iPads that are under everyone's Christmas tree this year, you know, uses the ARM processor. So the technology is at the cutting edge for, you know, low power, but the next step is to see if that can be adapted for HPC. And so, you know, I think that the Europeans have done a fantastic job of thinking through these issues and putting together a plan, and which happened over the last 18 months. Essentially, they started working on this plan 16 to 18 months ago and presented their initial first plan in October.
And this would be a little bit different than what we usually think of those countries being a lot more independent. So people might say, you know, for example, well, I would expect an exascale system to come out, you know, from Germany before any other countries. But you're talking about more of a cross-European collaboration, correct?
Yeah, you know, I think of this very much as sort of an Airbus strategy, right? Which is that there, and in fact, the IDC report, which is publicly available, points out that Europe as a whole has a tremendous amount of fantastic technology. It's just that it's in, you know, Spain and France and the UK and Germany and the Netherlands and other places. And if they weave that technology together, if they share a common target, then they can, in fact, be quite powerful. And, you know, Airbus is an example of taking the technology in Germany, in France, in the UK, and other places, and putting it together to make a single, you know, airframe and plane. And so I think that the Europeans are quite serious about pursuing high-performance computing and putting their technology and their labs' effort together, as well as solving the science problem. I mean, we've been talking mostly about the tech development, but the science is also something that they have tremendous strength in, everything from engineering and, you know, weather prediction and climate to materials and genomics and everything else, right?
So in addition to all that activity that you've, you know, had firsthand knowledge of, you've also seen a lot of the responses, or all the responses, I should say, to the recent round of RFPs. I know you can't talk about a lot of that in detail, but let me ask you, have you seen a promising roadmap that will get us there by 2018?
Well, all of the vendors, I don't want to make that, that's probably too general, but there are a lot of folks and responders who believe that there is a roadmap and a plan that they could get them in the 2018-2020 timeframe. Now, the reason I'm a little squishy on that 2018 or 2020, there's really two parts. One is no one really knows what's going to happen with the Congress and funding. And so, you know, we can't, without understanding what kind of investment there is, it's hard to know whether or not we'll make those targets.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is we really are dealing with new exciting technologies, which you can't always, and when you're looking that far out ahead, you know, maybe even, you know, 8 to 10 years ahead, it's pretty hard to understand whether or not a particular technology will pop in the way that you hope it does and provide you a solution. But people were, or companies were fairly positive on that, with the right investment that we could lead and make that and achieve those goals. Power would still be a problem, though. I mean, all of the companies pointed out that trying to hit a 20 megawatt power envelope would be very, very challenging, which we like. I mean, we absolutely want to challenge the companies to produce the extraordinarily power efficient, because, you know, this kind of technology, you know, supercomputing technology has always been sort of a time machine. It gives you a snapshot of what will be available in the commodity market 5 years later. And so, you know, you've seen what happens on the top 500, right? I mean, the machine gets to the top, and then every year starts dwindling down until it drops off, and it's even, you know, not even one of the top 500 machines. But that process is actually a good process. It means that that technology eventually gets embedded in the rest of the company and the rest of the community and is used. And we want the absolutely lowest power, most efficient machines that we can find and technology that we can develop, because this, you know, our nation's appetite for computing and cloud computing is continues to grow rapidly, you know, unbridled. You know, more and more things that we expect are run in the cloud, and that's taking a tremendous amount of power. I think there was recently an article about Google's power budget, you know, globally power budget, and it's quite large. And as we all, you know, watch more Netflix and run more internet services and push things out into the, you know, essentially the cloud, we want those we want the technology that we're developing now at exascale for power efficiency to find its way into the rest of the server world.
So are there some points about exascale that you would like to get across to the community that you don't think are being treated properly or communicated clearly enough?
Well, I think one of the things that we touched on was that it's not about a number one machine. I know that it's easy for people to get their heads around because, you know, it's like the mission to Mars, right, with NASA. You know, unless you can imagine, okay, they're going to send this to Mars. That's why they're going. They want to land this probe on Mars. Well, but there's so much more that is part of that mission and part of that science to understanding everything about, you know, from our planet to other planets to the universe. And the same is true for computing. It's not just about that number one or number three or the top few machines. It's about all of the science, the education, the new technology that will make it into servers and design-based planet that we will live in, where engineering and simulation help us make smart choices. That's why we invest in this space.
So let me ask you a kind of a tricky question here. The recent, let's call it disruption with Blue Waters, what kind of an impact do you think that's had on the HPC community?
That's actually a really good question. It's very fair. It was a tremendous disappointment in the community, I think, because there had never before in the community been a time where a very large company essentially chose to change course. There were, of course, you know, our field is replete with many a small company going out of business. I mean, I don't know how long you've been following supercomputer conferences, but yeah. You know, the companies that were there 15 years ago, you know, with the exception of just a handful, are not anywhere to be found. Ghosts like, you know, BBN and Thinking Machines and, you know, all of those, right? So it wasn't uncommon in our space because this is such a high-tech driven industry, for things to be in flux. But for a large company to make that choice that, look, this didn't end up where we thought it was going to end up, that was a surprise for us in the community. And now the good news is that I think it points a lot to the model that works well in these design build systems. So the BlueGene system was designed and built under the supervision and funding of the DOE through Argonne and Livermore Lab. So, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with it. Argonne and Livermore had a contract with IBM to design the BlueGene P and Q prototypes, which then, you know, get productized later and delivered to us, and we buy them. Mm-hmm. And that model has been very effective, which is that you work with a company, you're funding them, but you're also funding your own people to help with the design, because you're in it all along the way and can make those trade-offs of, oh, hey, look, this technology might not be cost-effective. We're going to have to change something, right? And you can make those trade-offs all through the process so that you end up at the end point with something that everyone can shake and not or nod their head at and say, yeah, this is where we wanted to be. The model that does not work so well is the I'm going to plop down a contract for something 5 years in the future, and all the technology has to work at the right levels and at the right price and the right way in order for that thing 5 years from now to be a viable, you know, cost-effective product. That's a, you know, in our world, that's a stretch, right? No one would do that. And I think that the Blue Waters problem demonstrated that the model that works best is a partnership on the architecture from the beginning with applications, with the DOE labs, and with the vendors so that, you know, those trade-offs can be made all along the way. And if progress isn't happening, then, of course, you have a go, no-go decisions all along the way during the R&D phase so that you never get to the end point and have a no-go, you know, at the very, very, very end. You've been right. Watching the whole process.
Well, much tighter tighter hold on the reins all the way along.
Yeah, it's a co-development strategy with, you know, the company. You know, Cray has done the same thing. You know, the whole Red Storm, original Red Storm machine was a partnership between Sandia and Cray. Mm-hmm. And those sort of very close partnerships on building very complex, you know, breakthrough, disruptive components along the way, they really need to be done in a collaborative environment where the trade-offs can be made. So to balance risk. You know, so let's look at the future, for example. We know that in the memory space, there are two new technologies that folks are interested in the solid state memory area, the non-volatile memory area. So one is memristor and the other is phase change memory. And these are both candidates for exascale computing. The question is for us, as we look to how do we interface with those industries to design and build and create the software to use those things, we need very close partnerships because right now those technologies are still under development and we need to be able to, you know, change path or change approach rapidly.
Reality is it's all going to come down to money. What's at stake here in February? What kind of, you know, funding are we looking for? And what happens if we don't get it?
The funding that we're looking for is, you know, when I look at it, it's quite modest. You know, the investment of several billion dollars over, you know, 10 years seems pretty small to me given the impact in technology and science and education. You know, the excitement that you can get behind a project like this, you know, all the way from the high schools all the way up to colleges and universities. So to me, but I don't live in Washington, to me it seems like a pretty, you know, a pretty good deal to invest, you know, handfuls of billion dollars over the next 10 years to maintain and exceed our current, position in technology and science in this computation space and simulation space. What's at risk is, well, if we fail to act, then leadership position that we enjoy right now because of previous smart people investing in science and technology, that leadership position will be in jeopardy. You know, it has a trickle down effect when our technology leadership and science leadership is weakened. And it goes all the way back down to, you know, the school systems and attracting people to work, attracting kids to decide to get a college degree in electrical engineering or computer science or physics or applied math.
Okay, what's your wish for a Christmas gift around Exascale?
Yeah, well. It would be great. You know, the letter from the senators to Obama was fantastic, and if there were more people jumping on the bandwagon in Washington, you know, senators and congressmen, and representatives jumping on, saying, "Look, we need to maintain. Look, we need to fix our budget, absolutely, but we need to maintain our science and technology position, and we need to, in fact, improve it and compete by, you know, designing these new systems." That would just be fantastic. I would have a great Christmas if people could get excited about science and technology leadership for the nation.